This is Smashville Live.
And the save made by Steros, and the Predators win it.
Welcome to Smashville Live
on ESPN.
102.5 The Game and the Game Nashville app. Streaming live on Facebook Live, Twitch, YouTube, and thegamenashville.com.
And that's right, everybody. Welcome in to Smashville Live here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're streaming on the Game Nashville app and also, of course, on Twitch, Twitter, YouTube, all of those things. You can watch us every Wednesday night at 6 on all of those platforms, of course, listen on your radio. Chase McCabe here with you and doing things a little bit different here tonight because, you know, everybody's travel schedule is weird. We were hoped to be joined by Darcy Hordachuk, former Predator, but he had some travel issues. And so our man Skillsy, Hal Gill, is stepping in. And we were just talking about this. He goes, so I'm the guest. I'm the Smashville Live guest. I'm still going to make him play analyst, but we'll get into some different moments from his career as well as we go along tonight. But Skillsy, you're out in lovely Los Angeles, and I know you have to be feeling good about that, even though with the protocols, can't do a whole lot.
Yeah, I don't know how much downtown LA I want to walk around, but we kind of locked down here. But hey, there's worse places to be. At least we're getting games and getting on the road, and Preds are playing some pretty good hockey, so it's fun to watch that as well.
Yeah, and you speak of the hockey that they're playing right now. They get the win last night, 3-2 over the Golden Knights. I know you were doing things from the television side with Willie D filling in for Mace, but let's start there because I've asked David Poile this several times when he's been on our show, which he comes on every Tuesday at 11:15. And I brought this up with you and Mace, and as we've talked about the Preds, that I like what I've seen against those teams that they should match up against and they should beat, like a Chicago or something like that. But it's been those measuring stick games, the Colorados, Vegas, you know, those top tier teams in the Western Conference and then around the league, Edmonton, that I wanted to see a little bit more earlier in the season. But I feel like you saw that last night, and this team is finally starting to play to the caliber that everybody maybe is surprised by, but that all of them on the inside knew that they could play to. In Vegas, that win last night was huge.
Yeah, I think it was a measuring stick game for sure. And I feel like they went out and played it with that kind of jam, that playoff intensity, that fight. That's really what's the identity for the team that's become an every night kind of thing, right? They're fighting for each other. They're playing a physical hard game, blocking shots for each other. I feel like that mentality is giving them a chance to win every night. And then their big guns are scoring. Their secondary scoring is there. Forsberg had a beautiful goal last night that, you know, you need him to make those big plays, and he got you that big goal and scored another goal, and guys are making plays. And so it's not just a meat and potatoes team. It's the meat and potatoes, but they got some good sauce on it too. So they're doing kind of everything and finding ways to win games. And that compete that they bring every night is something that is going to get them a long way, I think. And especially in games like Vegas, the big guns.
We'll get to Forsberg in a second, because obviously one of his goals last night is getting a lot of talk, and then him in general.
Yeah,
big time. But I want to talk about Tanner Janot. I know that you and Mace and Willie have all started making that Calder campaign for him. But you look at his game, and you talked about it last night on the broadcast, that he was skating up to the Vegas bench, like going, hey, bring it, let's go. You guys want to rumble? Like, but he can also score on you and then run you over in the next play.
Yeah, he's got a good mix of it all. I mean, he's doing everything right now. Where do you want to start? The thing and talking about being competitive every night, he's a big part of the reason that they are, because every night he brings something. Every night he's heavy on the forecheck. He's finishing his checks. He's not just finishing, he's punishing defensemen. He's making the game hard to play. And I can tell you, if I'm playing on any other team and they come into town, I'm looking at Tanner Janot going, I better move the puck quick. I better get rid of it because I'm going to get crushed. And so he brings that every night. He's throwing in pretty good fights. He had another good fight the other night, last night, and that was that sends a statement. Guys see that. But then killing penalties, he's been really good. He's playing a ton of minutes on the penalty kill. He's blocking shots. He's got a great stick. He's got speed and size, and so he's able to use that to close time and space on the penalty kill. So he's getting it done there, and then he's using his speed and size to score goals. He's driving the net. Every time he gets the puck or supporting a play, he's attacking the net. He's funneling towards the post, and he's got good hands. He's got a good shot. He's able to put it in the back of the net. And so really he's a total package. He has to be, if not the front runner, he's close to that Calder Trophy candidate. I mean, he is the total package, and he's getting it done really with playing, not to look down on Sissons and Trennan, but that's an identity line, not a goal scoring line. He's got the numbers to match against guys that are playing with pretty good players, younger guys that are playing with talented players. They're looking for them to score goals. They're not looking for Janot to go out and score goals, but he's doing it anyway.
When I ask guys like Brent Peterson or Terry Crisp, you know, the old school coaches that, you know, played and coached in a different era, I say, hey, who on this team really intrigued you that you would love to coach? Tanner Janot is the first name that comes up, because he's kind of that mix between the old school and just the grit and all of that stuff, and then the new school with some of the skill that he possesses. And I think that's really cool how John Hines and his staff have tried to combine those two things.
Yeah, and you know, I've heard stories about him, like going through junior and going and his development, and every coach along the way has said the same thing. I love this guy. I'm rooting for him, you know, and it hasn't been, he's not the blue chip prospect that everyone gave him a chance, and he's had to earn every chance he's gotten. He's had to compete at every level to be relevant. And so he's got that workman mentality. He's like impeccable condition. He's just a chiseled beast. He looks like Superman walking into a room. And so you can see he's worked hard for it, and he's battled at every level, and he continues to battle every night. That's not an easy job. You know, like I've been there where you're trying to be physical. There's a lot of guys that are pretty tough in the NHL, and they'll call you out, and you have to be ready to answer the bell. And he's done that consistently with hitting guys and then standing up and fighting guys. That's not an easy job to do every night. And he's done it for the majority of the season. Every night he's had to do something to impose his will on the other team.
Chase McCabe, Hal Gill here with you on Smashville Live, presented by New Amsterdam Vodka, Spring Hill Heating and Cooling, and Red Spirits and Wine. And I'll relate this to you and your journey and your career, and then just players in general today. But you look at Janot's role, and you know what it is. He was on that identity line. Now he's scoring, but he's a physical guy. You look at Philip Forsberg, he's paid to score goals. That's what he is. As you're coming up through peewee and juniors and all of those things, what is the journey like to kind of determine what your role as a hockey player is going to be? Because I would imagine that every kid, when they put on a pair of skates, they're immediately thinking, I want to be Gretzky. I want to be Ovechkin. I want to be, you know, this superstar. But we know that not everybody can do that.
Yeah, no, it's funny because, you know, you go when you're a kid. Yeah, I used to go coast to coast when I was playing. I wasn't a stay-at-home defenseman when I was growing up. I was a beast. I'm going to go score goals. And then, you know, you get to the next level and you start to realize, okay, this is how I have to be successful. And this is how I have to play. And a lot of guys don't get that. They don't understand it. You know, they say, hey, I'm a pure goal scorer, or I'm a puck mover. And then they get to the NHL and it's the game gets a lot faster. It's bigger, stronger guys that you're playing against. And so there's guys that have to change their game. And so, you know, Forsberg is an elite level shooter. And so he's going to score goals, but he's also got to realize that he can't score goals from the perimeter. He's got to play a power game too, to get into scoring position. And that's a lot harder to do. So he's growing his game. You look at Tanner Janot, he's got to play that physical hard game to get in the NHL. And if he starts scoring goals, then they say, okay, maybe he's a little bit more. So you have to have something that you bring to the team that you can do to get into the league. and then you can grow your game from there. But a lot of guys miss it and don't realize what their real identity is going to be in the NHL, whether that's killing penalties or grinding on the third or fourth line. You have to pay your dues sometimes to get there.
Is Eli Tolvanen a good example of somebody that maybe when he first came up or first got to North America, he didn't quite understand that, but now he has, and you look at his overall game and how it's evolved?
Isn't it great to watch that? Because I remember when he came over, this guy's got a great shot. Wow. And he, all of a sudden you're like, okay, he's can't get that shot off. You know, he had a couple he had a couple heaters where he was on the power play and he was smoking it, picking corners. But the game is tougher. It's not that easy. And he really changed his game. Like, if you watch the way he plays now, you'd never guess that he was the same player that came over and was trying to be a sniper. Obviously, he's got a great shot. He's using that. But how many deflection goals has he had where he's got to fight to get into the interior? That's a game changer for him. That's not his normal, what he grew up doing. He had to change his game and be more physical. Now, you watch him last night, he's just throwing his body all over there, blocking big shots, laying down.
Like 5 or 6 hits.
And just crushing guys, throwing his body at guys. And that was never his game. But he realized, hey, if I want to play in the NHL and be in the best league in the world, I'm going to have to add that to my game, because it's just not that easy to go and score goals at the NHL level. So I give him a ton of credit. You know, that's not easy to do. It's, you know, like, I had a conversation with him and I said, is it hard sometimes to not open up and get out of the slot and like kind of fade away from that defenseman? And that's where he wants to be, like open up for the one timer, move off to the side to get in a scoring position. Instead, he's grinding, putting his nose, getting dirty, fighting through defensemen to get to the net. And that's a huge change in mentality for a young player to have, and he's done it. And to his credit, it's been hard, but he's another guy that's a big part of this team every night, not just because he's scoring goals, but because he's playing hard.
He is Hal Gill, Predators radio and television analyst, joining us here tonight as we talk a little Nashville Predators. We'll step away, come back with more here on Smashville Live, presented by Red Spirits and Wine, Spring Hill Heating and Cooling, and New Amsterdam Vodka on ESPN 102.5 The Game and The Game Nashville app. Welcome back into Smashville Live here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're also streaming on Twitch, Twitter, YouTube, all of those things, The Game Nashville app. And, of course, you can listen on the air as well every Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. It's all presented by New Amsterdam Vodka, Spring Hill Heating and Cooling, and Red Spirits and Wine. Chase McCabe and Skillsy Hal Gill here with you tonight. And I said we were going to get to Philip Forsberg. Let's start with that second goal of his last night. Was gross. I texted Darren McFarland. I said, that is absolutely gross. Just nasty. And I could hear you and Willie on the TV broadcast. I went back and listened to Pete's call. I mean, everybody thought the same thing. But he continues to amaze and do things like that. It just shows his skill.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That play is a good combination of everything that Phil can bring to the table. I mean, like, first of all, he's got Pietrangelo. He knows he's a good defenseman. So more than likely, Phil Forsberg is coming in and he's going to drive that defenseman wide, try to push Pietrangelo back, stop up, pull off to the side to open up a passing lane. Instead, surprising to Pietrangelo, obviously, is he flips it up. And then not only as he's flipping it up, he's got a big power push coming off the wing and leans on Pietrangelo, gets his edges set on him. And as he's doing that, he flicks it out of the air. He like bumps it again out of midair to get it past him. Then has that pull away stride to get past him, and leaves Pietrangelo spinning, and then the quick stop up to the backhand finish. Like, he's putting a lot of different skill sets to work in one play. And, you know, that's a game changer. You know, if you can have a guy that can make a play out of nothing, that changes the game big time. And just an unreal highlight goal, but just a showcase of all his skill sets. Really fun to watch.
And obviously the big conversation with him is what's next. The contract, it ends after this season. David Poile I've asked him about it several times of, you know, where are you? And there's no really new movement on it. I know Philip Forsberg doesn't really like to talk about it as he's focused on playing hockey as he should be, but obviously it's a big topic. So from a player's point of view, you've been through this in your career, you know, what are kind of the process? What is kind of the process and the steps that you go through knowing that that is looming, that you have to have that contract negotiation?
Yeah. Everyone deals with it differently. You know, for me, I can speak, I wanted my agent to handle it. I didn't want to talk about it. You know, there's certain things that as a player, you're trying to, you know, if you have a contract, you just want to win. I mean, bottom line is if you're on a winning team, everyone gets paid because you're part of a team that wins. You go out and win the cup in a contract year, you're going to make your money. It doesn't matter what you do. You're just part of a winning team. But then you look through, you know, obviously for Phil, he wants to put up numbers. He's got to show that he can play in different situations. He's a power play guy that can score goals. He wants to do all these things. He wants to obviously have the highlight reel goals, but he's got to show a full body of work in order to get that contract. And so I'm imagining putting myself in Phil's shoes. It would be like, all right, I'm going to talk to my agent. I'll check in with him, but you don't want to be bogged down with that conversation every day. Did you talk to Poyle today? You know, if there's something new comes up, of course you want to be informed, but you don't want it looming because then it becomes, I hate to say it, because it's a game. You know, you're going out to play a game and you don't want it. As soon as you're talking about money, every time you jump on the ice, it becomes a job. And, yeah. There's a delicate balance that a lot of guys have a hard time with. But in the end, if you go out and Phil's doing it right, he's on a team, he's scoring goals and they're winning, you're going to get paid. And so he's got to have a good feeling about it. Now, how that plays out, you know, and David Poyle's side of it, it's a tough one because, you know, you can't let Philip Forsberg go because, man, he's a big part of the why you're winning and you don't want to lose a guy like that. But you don't want to lose a guy at the end of the season anyway, if he moves on to greener pastures or whatever. But I really think there's going to be something that'll get worked out just because Phil's playing for a contending team right now. And he's a big part of this community and everyone loves him here. And I think he loves being in Nashville. He likes this core group of guys. And so I can't imagine that something wouldn't get done, but a lot of season left and a lot of that needs to be discussed. And ultimately it comes down to money and where's he going to get money and can the Preds give it to him?
Yeah, no doubt. And I think too, and you know, everyone's kind of discussed this team went through some changes. Longtime members of the Preds, Ryan Ellis, Victor Arvidsson, you know, others in the last few years have moved on, whether it be free agency or being traded or something like that. And I can understand when you've played with the same group of guys for basically your whole career, that transition is tough. And so he's also in a position where he can sit there and go, well, maybe I need to ride this out for a little bit and see if this is still the place that I actually want to be. Now, the vibe I get is the answer to that is yes, that the way the team's playing, the fact that you got guys like Johansson and Duchesne that are playing better, which in turn are going to help Forsberg have, you know, up his game and play as well as he's playing. It all makes sense to keep it together. But from your point of view as a former player, I mean, how much do you kind of evaluate the team, the organization, even though you've been here and know everybody, of kind of what the future looks like?
Yeah, that it's tough because the last thing you want to do as a player is say, all right, I'm going to go on to another team and then watch the Preds start to rack up cups and Phil's, you know, goes on to another team and he sits there and watches. That's the biggest hurt you could feel. Right. So I think he wants to stay around here and be part of that. And it just, you know what, the funny thing is like, it's a good problem to have, but it's like the toughest decision because everything is going so well that you want to get this deal done, but everyone else wants a player like Phil Forsberg. And so he's going to get offers. He's going to have David Poyle's going to have a bunch of offers on his table. And so Phil's going to be, you know, how much is he involved in that? How much to say does he have? Does he go and say, like, David, I really want to sign. Like, let's get this deal done. That means a lot to as a player to come out and say that. You know, that's the conversations that you're going to have. That's the one thing you can say is, I want to be here. The, ultimately, you can say that. And more often than not, if you want to be here and the team wants you to be here, then, you know, it's going to work out.
Hal Gill, Chase McCabe here with you on Smashville Live. And something that I mentioned in my last question, the fact that you have Duchesne, I'll put Granlund in there, and obviously Johansson playing as well as they are, having, you know, Duchesne's best season as a Predator, Granlund's best season as a Predator, and maybe Johansson's best in a few years, there's a trickle-down effect there. I mean, that obviously affects a guy like Forsberg that plays alongside all of those guys, whether it's five on five or power play. So it's almost like it's become contagious, and therefore that's why you're seeing some of the results you're seeing with the team as a whole.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is it's almost a trickle up effect, right?
Yeah. 'Cause
last year, those guys weren't clicking. Those guys weren't getting it done. Johansson and Duchesne, you know, Granlund worked hard. You know, Phil was streaky. Those guys, you know, we're sputtering at best. And then you look at what the Beast line did. You have Trennan, Olivier, Sissons. They kind of became the identity of the team. And they were the reason, with Saros, the reason that they climbed back in and made a push at the end of the season. They're the reason that they had success. And I look at Forsberg, Johansson, Duchesne, looking back at these guys and going, wow, they're driving the team, and we should be driving the team. I think it was a wake-up call for those guys. And they said, all right, if they're going to play a hard-nosed, grinding, forecheck style of play, then we better match it, because they're making us look bad. And I think they kind of got a little burr up their butt and got going. And it's fun to see that when those guys play with that mentality, with that push, that forecheck, and they're getting rewarded for it. It just kind of it steamrolls, and everyone starts to go on the same page and play the same way.
In the almost 25 years that this organization, this team has existed, they have had a knack for finding defensemen and goaltenders and really good ones. Obviously, yeah. from a defense side, we know what Roman Josi's doing right now. He's well on his way, in my opinion, to another Norris Trophy. Shea Weber, Ryan Suter from the past, Ryan Ellis, the Matthias Ekholm, the list goes on. And then goaltending, it's kind of like you start with Mike Dunham, you get Vokoun, Mace is in there, then you have a long time with Pekka, and now they've transitioned to UC Saros. Can you put your finger on why they've just been so good at selecting those two positions?
I think, first of all, I'll speak on defense. You have to be patient with young players. You know, I think David Poile has done a great job of saying, all right, let's let this guy's game grow. Like, Matthias Ekholm is a great example. Like, when he came up and played a couple games when I was playing, he was not a good player. He was not strong enough. He got kind of out-muscled, and he didn't deserve to be in the league. And David Poile had the patience to say, all right, go learn the game. Go play. Go develop. And now he's one of the best defensemen in the game, a solid, strong guy, battles and plays against the top lines because they were patient with him. I think it has a lot to do with the market. You know, if you look at Toronto and Montreal, you know, a defenseman will come up and get a goal, and they'll talk about him for 3 days about how great he is. Well, maybe he's not ready to be at that level, but he got a goal and everyone's excited about him. The market will blow him up, and they'll talk about how this is the next coming of Bobby Orr, and they'll get excited about it. And it kind of ruins that development. You know, Roman Josi spent his time in the minors, you know, like he grounded out and learned the game and developed the right way and made mistakes. And they didn't roll over on him and say, hey, you're never going to play again because you make bad mistakes, and had success, but didn't get too hyped up about it. So I think that's a perfect ground to grow. And I think they've done the same thing with goaltending. I think Pex really learned his game. Juice was underneath Pex, learning from Pex. And then that succession kind of turned over. And it'd be interesting to see where Askarov comes in, and a young goalie that's a great talent, but he's got a lot of work to do to learn how to play the right way. But he's got a great future ahead of him. How long can they wait before they bring him over? And it'll be interesting to see how that jives with coming over and playing a few years in the AHL. And if he becomes the next UC Saros that learns from UC Saros, it's kind of a good system that they have. And David Poile has been really patient with it and done it the right way.
Well, and it's funny, some of those names that you mentioned, you know, defense wise, it's been almost 10 years since you got traded to Nashville, which is kind of funny to look at. February 2012 is when you were traded from Montreal to the Nashville Predators. You saw Ekholm and Josi and Ellis, like you saw them young when they were just first coming up. So what is it kind of like for you? Do you feel like the proud uncle or something like that, seeing these guys?
Well, it's funny because, you know, you always hear like, this guy's going to be a great player. And you don't really see it until you're around a guy all the time. You know, like Ryan Ellis was a great example of, like, you know, he was my partner and I'm going, all right, kid, go show us what you got. I know you score a ton of goals. Go join the Rush. I'll back you up. And Ryan Ellis is looking at me going, that's not the way I play. I'm like, go, kid, make mistakes. You know, like, I've got to cover you. That's my job, is to cover for your bad rookie mistakes. And he didn't make those rookie mistakes. He just was kind of steady. And so I got to see it over playing with him and seeing him in practice, how hard he works. You know, there's a lot of things that go into being a good defenseman. You have to work hard. You have to be committed to watching video, learning from each play. And it was fun seeing him do that. And Roman Josi, you're like, okay, this guy is an amazing skater. If he can learn how to play solid defense, pick his spots, know when to go and when to stay back. And now you look at him and it doesn't matter. He can go every time. He can still get back. It's like an amazing to see how far those guys have come. And yeah, to be part of it, you know, it's fun. Like even PK Subban, I played with him in Montreal. Yeah. And it's, you know, hopefully down the road when they retire, they'll look back and say, you know, I learned something from Hal Gill. And that's something that I take a lot of pride in, because I had to go through the same thing playing with Ray Bourque. I learned a lot from him. I learned a lot from a lot of guys. Dave Ellett was always in my ear, giving me bad criticism, good criticism, you know, just teaching me how to play the game and how to be a professional.
He's Hal Gill, a part of the radio team, the television team, and former Nashville Predator as well, joining us here on Smashville Live. We'll come back and talk a little bit about Hal's career and his journey to Nashville. Hard to believe it's been 10 years since he was traded to the Predators. We'll do that next. Smashville Live, presented by Red Spirits and Wine, Spring Hill Heating and Cooling, and New Amsterdam Vodka on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Back here on Smashville Live here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're on Twitch, Twitter, YouTube as well. Chase McCabe and Hal Gill here with you, all brought to you by New Amsterdam Vodka, Spring Hill Heating and Cooling, and Red Spirits and Wine on a Wednesday night, every Wednesday at 6. So, Skillsy, we said that I used you as the analyst in the first half. Now we're going to use you as the guest here in the second half of the show. And we were kind of just talking during the break of when you got drafted by the Boston Bruins. So you and Pekka have something in common. You're both drafted in a round that doesn't exist anymore in the eighth round. So you got that going for you, but you got drafted, you played college, and then you jump into the NHL with the Boston Bruins. And who was it that was your first defense partner?
Yeah. Ray Bourque. You imagine that, growing up in Boston and having Ray Bourque be my first partner. I played with him for 3 years. And, you know, I don't want to take all the credit, but he was an all-star for all those 3 years that I played with him. So, actually, Chase, I mean, if we're going to go down that, you skipped over the draft, right? I had no idea the draft was going on. It was eighth round. I had no idea it was happening. I went and picked up the phone, and it was the Boston Bruins and Joe Lyons calling from the Boston Bruins. I kind of laughed. I thought it was one of my buddies making a joke. And I'm like, hey, you were drafted. And I was like, I don't really even understand what that means. I think I even like told my mom, I'm like, I don't know, someone's talking about something. I might've handed the phone off. So I was, to say I was a dark horse, I was just a big kid, and they were like, "Yeah, let's throw it out. Maybe this kid will pan out." And so it was kind of a funny story that I went through that. Went to Providence College, played my 4 years, didn't expect much after that. And then I went to a camp, and I remember Jonathan Aiken was a holdout. He was a high draft pick, first overall, and he was a holdout for like 2 weeks. And so I went into camp, kind of jumped on his spot, and had to fight my way through camp and ended up with a spot. And I remember I was we were doing team picture day. And so I'm sitting there doing my hair. I made the team, and Ray Bourque came around the corner, looks at me in the mirror doing my hair, and he starts singing, "Looks like he made it." And I was like, that was when it hit in, like, hey, I'm on the Boston Bruins and Ray Bourque is singing to me and he's my partner. And like, that was a pretty crazy moment in my life.
It's kind of funny because you mentioned you grew up in Boston. So you grew up I assume a Bruins fan,
yeah,
you know, in that area, idolizing Ray Bourque. Then you play with Ray Bourque, and you don't hear stories like that of a kid that gets drafted by the hometown team. And it's kind of ironic because Blake Jeffrion, who the Predators traded for, yeah, you, grew up in Nashville as, you know, the first homegrown kid. So that's kind of funny how that worked out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is crazy. I guess in the end, like, I didn't realize how special it was. I was just nose to the grindstone doing whatever I could to stay in the league and be a part of it. But looking back, I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
So what was it like, you know, in the, I guess, the late 90s, playing for the Boston Bruins, one of these historic teams? You're learning the ropes from these veteran guys about the league. What was your first couple of seasons like? And you know, how big of the, you know, were the lights bright at any point for you?
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? I was just so young and dumb. I guess I didn't, believe it or not, Chase, I was a loudmouth, and I was just like,
really?
I wasn't cocky, but I just was having fun with whatever I was doing. I think I came off as cocky at times. But to people that knew, it wasn't an arrogance. It was just, I was having fun with it. I will tell you a funny story. Like, my first game as a Boston Bruin, I wasn't in the lineup. I went out, took warm up, Pat Burns. I said, what am I doing here? And he said, just skate up and down, back and forth on the red line and stare at the other team. So a 6'7" defenseman just staring. I was the tallest guy in the league at that point. And so I was just staring at the other team. I had no idea what I was doing, and I couldn't fight my way out of a paper bag, but I was out there doing it. And so after I trained with Mike Boyle, was the strength coach. So I knew him pretty well. And so I went in after, and, you know, if you're not playing, you go in, you get a workout after, ride the bike, do a lift. And then after the first period, Mike said, hey, let's go upstairs and we'll watch the game from up top. And I was like, okay, great. So I knew Mike Boyle well, and he was strength coach. So I was friends with him. And so I went up, and we went up to the Halo at the Boston Garden. And I went up, grabbed 2 hot dogs, 2 beers, and went over and sat down next to Mike. I'm like, Mike, I got you a beer if you want. If not, I'll drink it, you know, because, you know, the 2 beer, you're allowed to get 2 beers. So I'm
right.
Allowed to get 2. And he looked at me, he goes, what are you doing? I was like, well, I did my workout. Like, I can have a hot dog and a beer, right? And he's like, no, put it away. Like, I had a lot to learn, you know, about being a pro, but it was fun. And when back then, the old grizzled veterans, they teach you pretty quick, you know. Like, I get yelled at for being in the training room. Like, what are you doing in here, kid? Get out of here. You're not supposed to be in here until 10 years. Then you can come in and get treatment. It was old school back then, and I had a lot to learn. But you know, now I look back on it, and I'm grateful for all those guys and all the stupid things that I did.
You obviously were a physical player in the league, and, you know, could drop the mitts, big guy. It's what you're expected to. But you used the phrase "couldn't fight out of a paper bag." How did kind of that all come to be?
I was just big. My first training camp, and it's funny, I've talked to scouts now they said, okay, there's this college kid coming in to a training camp in the NHL, and he's never fought before. And so they wanted to see, like, what's this kid made of? Can he fight? Will he fight? And so it was dumb luck, really. In the first training camp, I cross-checked someone. I skated away. He tapped me on the shoulder. I turned back around. The kid's name was Eric No. He was like a French kid from Quebec, and he punched me right in the nose. Blood went everywhere, and I turned and just started chucking him. And I, you know, I did all right in the fight, other than the first punch that labeled me. But I stayed all right in that fight. And I talked to the scouts now that said, we're all looking at you saying, what's he going to do? And I went out, maybe two or three shifts later. This is training camp with my own team, right?
Yeah.
And I went over and hit another guy. He turned around and stared at me, and I just started chucking him again. So it's like the first scrimmage, and I didn't know it at the time. I was just self-defense. You know, everyone wanted to fight the big guy and show how tough they were. And so I just started chucking him, and I talked to the scouts now after going around the rinks, and they said, you kind of sealed the deal. You know, you're a big guy and you're willing to chuck. It didn't matter if I wasn't good at fighting. I wasn't a technical fighter. I never fought, but I was going out there and I played with that, with the, you know, working at it, you know, willing to chuck them and willing to fight. And that got me on the team. And so it's kind of funny when you look back, it may be dumb luck, but you know, as a big guy, I had to fight. You know, like my first year, every knucklehead came right at me, you know, Joey Koser. I went through the list of everyone I had to fight, and you know, all these heavyweights, but at least I showed up. But I wasn't a good fighter though. I was just big and holding off and trying to swing when I could.
Chase McCabe, Hal Gill here with you. And fighting in those days was obviously different than it is now, even though we've seen this Predators team with guys like Janot and Trennan and others. You know, they're not afraid.
Or Vieski, man, he's just been a beast.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's old school, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Every night they're sticking up for each other and fighting. I love it.
So they're, you know, I've talked to Stu Grimson about this before, that, you know, he and Christoph Oliwa would have different bouts with each other, and it would basically be like, hey, we need a spark, so let's go. What were kind of some funny moments of like the fighter, the enforcer on the other team, and you, and it's, you kind of skate around each other. It's like, hey, you know, we kind of need to go. We need to get the spark going in this game. Was there chirping or kind of what set it all up?
You know what? I will say I love the fact that in the NHL you can fight, because there's times when you're trying to battle a guy and you get pissed off and you want to fight. I mean, that's the way it is. And that's what I love about it. The hardest part is knowing you have to fight a guy and knowing he's there and trying to go to bed the night before. You're looking at that game on the schedule and going, I got to fight this guy. That sucks. That is a hard job to do. And I have a ton of respect for the guys that did that, but it played mind games with me, and it was really hard. There were certain guys I knew they were coming after me. Talk about Darcy Hordichuk. He was constantly chirping, I'm going to fight, you know, like I'm going to have to fight this lunatic, you know. there's guys that you just knew that you're going to have to step up, and that's not a fun way to go about your day. And so I never got into that where like, hey, let's go, let's be a spark. Cause I wasn't a crazy, you know, for me, I wasn't a great fighter, so I wasn't going to just destroy guys. And if someone knocked down the 6'7" guy, they looked pretty good. So it's kind of a lose-lose deal for me. But that being said, I was always going after their skill guys. So I'd get, you know, these crazy guys coming after me, Pete Worrell, Chris Simon, you know, there's just beasts everywhere. We had our own tough guys, so we all stick together. And the big guys, the tough guys would a lot of times jump in and fight those heavyweights. And I'd be like, thank God they took them, cause I don't have to. But I will say one of the most memorable ones was Joey Koser. My father-in-law showed me a picture of his hand in the newspaper the day before. He was in Detroit and his hand is just a mangled mess of scars, tissue, and cuts. And he's one of the toughest guys in the league. And I go out and we're in starting lineup. He comes right over, elbow in my ear. And he's not a big guy, but he jumped up and I was like, oh God, I got to do this. And afterwards, you know, I avoided getting destroyed. I got him with a couple rights and we tied up at the end of the fight and the linesman came in and he looked at me. He's like, good job, kid. Good job. And I was like, man, that is cool that you jump in and these guys are willing to punch each other in the face. But then after say, hey, that was good. That was a good fight. Good job. And that was something that I think a lot of people don't understand about fighting in the NHL is that respect level that a lot of guys have. And, you know, I look at Yakov Trenin, who dummied Zdeno Chara. I fought Chara, and that's not, you know, I took a beating. But he dummied him, knocked him, buckled him, brought him to his knees. And I asked him when it's the second fight earlier this year, and I said, you could have just skated away there. And he's like, no, I owed it to him. He needed another chance. And like for a young guy like Yak to recognize that, and that's old school, man. That's like as old school as you get. Like there's a lot of players now that would be like, no, I already fought you. I'm not doing that. That's stupid. I'm not doing it again. But he's old school enough to do that. And that's what you have to do. If you want to fight, you'd have to go back and fight the guy again, just out of respect. And so I think I have a ton of respect for Yak for doing that. And I was there. I had to go through that.
He's Hal Gill, one half of the radio team alongside the Hall of Famer Pete Weber and also the TV side on Bally Sports. We'll come back and talk about a guy that he played with for a couple of years that's going to have a very special moment coming up later in February. We'll do that when we come back here on we'll be back here on Smashville Live here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're back here on Smashville Live here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're streaming on the Game Nashville app, on Twitch, on Twitter, on YouTube as well. It's all presented by New Amsterdam Vodka, Spring Hill Heating and Cooling, and Red Spirits and Wine. Chase McCabe and Hal Gill, Skillsy, one half of the radio team here on ESPN 102.5 The Game and television on Bally Sports as well. So as I said, going into the break, February 24th, they're going to hang a number from the rafters at Bridgestone Arena. It's never been done before. It's going to be the digits 3 and 5, of course, for Pecorine, who you played with for a couple of seasons when you were here in Nashville and played against him, played with him. He had such a tremendous career. And then you got to cover him as a broadcaster too. But for you personally, what is that night, that moment going to be like?
Well, first of all, like, what a jerk, huh? I mean, isn't that the worst? No, like no one likes him, right?
Not at all.
Honestly, it's almost nauseating how many people love Pex. Like, and I'll say playing with him, it's not just people that are around him. It's people he bumps into in the street. They're like, wow, I can't believe how nice that guy is. You know, he's just the best guy ever. Like, to as a human, right? And sure. So never mind the hockey side of it, what he's done for Nashville and the 365 Pediatric Cancer Fund, like everything he's done around Nashville is the gold standard, right? Just you can't be a better guy, with best buddies, with all that, and it really, like, it means a lot to him, you know. So now you talk about what he was as a teammate, like just the best guy to be around. His competitive level was like, it was kind of quiet, but the way he competed in practice, the way he competed with everything he did, even if you go golf with him, he's just a competitor, right? But it's a quiet, it's not a loud in your face. It's just a still waters run deep, right? I mean, he was a competitor and, willing to give you everything you got every night. And then for me, maybe the best part about it is that he had fun with it. Like, we had a good time, and he would bust his butt every night, and afterwards he would enjoy it. He'd put it to bed and he'd be the best guy again. You know, we go out and have a couple beers, and he was always a that big smile with a couple laughs. I'm amazed by how he was to be around. And then to talk about what he's done and accomplished as a goaltender, there's no one tougher. You know, I used to laugh because he just takes Shea Weber one-timers from the point over and over again, and almost like laugh, like glove save. Like, it was embarrassing. Like, I had a hard shot, right? And he would just laugh and make every save a glove save. I'd go low stick side and he'd save it with his glove. And I'd be like, dude, you know, can you just let one in? You know, it was just kind of funny how gifted he was athletically. And then, you know, the way he played, his technical side, is he was just awesome. And big games, I like, you know what, probably the biggest thing about him is he would have a bad game. He'd never have two bad games. It was right. Always the next game he was going to be a beast. And that spoke to his competitive side, where he was always going to come back and give you a great game on the heels of a bad one. And that's not easy to do, to not let it snowball.
What cracks me up is former players, former teammates of his will always say that what you just said, that he's the nicest guy, and they never saw him get mad, except for in practice, if you would score on him. Jordan Tutu told the story of how, you know, he would score on him in practice and Pekka would just stare him down and you could tell it just pissed him off. But that was the compete level with him.
And that's the fun part, right? I mean, you don't want someone that you go out and you practice and you score and like you want someone that gets a little upset about that. And he was furious. He took a lot of pride, not just in the games, but going out there. And, you know, he'd stay out after and take shots. I'm like, dude, you stopped 50 chances last night, take a break. And he'd still be out there working on his game.
The thing that's so cool about him from my side of things is, you know, I've told the story before, when he had got his 300th win, you know, he did the interview with Kara on the bench and he did, you know, another interview and then all the media stuff. And, you know, I had asked like, hey, is there a chance for radio? Can I get my one-on-one with him? And you know, they're like, I don't know. He's done a lot. I don't think he's going to be able to. And I said, okay, cool. And I'm standing there in the locker room and I'm going to go talk to another player. And I hear Chase and I turn around and he's sitting at his locker and he waves me over and he said, did you need me? And I was like, Pex, you've done enough. You're good. And he goes, come on, let's do this. Like you got a job to do. Let's do this. And so he gave me the interview and, you know, like motioned to Kevin and PR and said, it's cool. And like, that's the kind of guy he is. And if I'd walk in the locker room, you know, he'd ask me how I'm doing and be joking around. There was one time that I was standing there and I was kind of tired. And he said, you look tired. And I had actually, like, we had gone for beers with you and Mace. And I told him that. And he said, oh, okay, that makes sense. I know why. But he was so down to earth. And, you know, and that's what's so neat about him.
Yeah. And you know what? Maybe the biggest accolade you could give a guy is he brought in the guy who's going to take his job. Right. He brought in Yuki Saros, lived with him, brought him in, made him dinner, like took care of him, taught him what it is to be an NHL goaltender, and just helped and never a bitter word. And they had a great goaltending battle to see who was going to be playing game in, game out. And he handled that with such grace. That's amazing to me because there's never, and I'd ask him about Juice. He'd be like, man, he's good. He's really good. Like he's going to be legit. And then I said, do you want, and he goes, no, I want to fight for that spot. I want that spot. I want to win. Like we need me to win games. And so to be able to balance that, like, I want to help this kid out and treat him like a son. And he called him son, you know, like he really did take him in as a son and competed for that same job. But was able to balance that. I can't say enough about how hard that is and how much grace he had to be able to do that. And, you know, you look at his last game, you know, I'm crying in warmups as everyone was cheering for a warmup. They cheered for a warmup. And I'm sitting there going, if that's his last game, like that, what an amazing way to go out. And then you know, he's a humble guy. He's going to get off, and all his teammates say, no, take a lap. This is it. And they all said, we hope he takes another lap somewhere down the road. But if he doesn't, he's going to miss out on this opportunity. So all his teammates standing up and making him do that. And the appreciation I think he had for the fans and the appreciation the fans had for him is something that you'll never see again. That's something special.
Well, no doubt about it. And February 24th is going to be a fun night for sure at Bridgestone Arena. Skillsy, thanks so much for doing this tonight. It's been a lot of fun. It's flown by, but we will be watching, listening wherever we can find you. That's where we will be, but appreciate it.
I appreciate you, bud. Thanks for having me on as an analyst and as a guest.
Yes, absolutely. Hal Gill, one half of the radio team and also on the TV side here on Smashville Live. My thanks to New Amsterdam Vodka, Spring Hill Heating and Cooling, and Red Spirits and Wine for joining us here tonight. Stick around. Penalty Box Radio is next on ESPN 102.5 The Game.